as it's so impactful about the history of Israel during the time of the New Testament. So let's open in prayer. Father, thank you so much that, again, we can gather together as your people and to see how you have worked with your people to develop people for yourself. And as we approach the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ in our studies, we just thank you for the way that you continue to sovereignly supervene over all the events of history. As we look upon some of those times this morning, Father, my prayer is that you'll be with Will as he brings this to us, and that we will be blessed by it. My prayer in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen.
We want to thank Will Hubbard for coming and being with us today. He's had an interest in this topic for some time, and so I thought I'd tap into his expertise.
All right. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here and be able to talk to everybody this morning. So as you can see, we're going to do the history of Rome. But there's an asterisk. I'm an attorney, of course. So there's a disclaimer in 45 minutes. So we'll see what we can do. But anyway, we're just going to kind of jump right in and happy Easter as well. So let me get it swiping here. All right. So the kind of the origins of Rome, we're just going to jump right in, like I said. The Romans themselves told a lot of stories about their origins. One of the best known one is that they were descendants of the Trojans. So you remember you have the Trojan War. It's a big conflict between Greece, for lack of a better term. And in Asia Minor, there is a city called Troy. And so that was a foundational story for many ancient peoples in the Mediterranean, the Greeks specifically, but also the Romans, who are distinct from the Greeks, but also culturally inherited a lot of things from them. So the hero that they claim descent from is Aeneas. What's his name? And so Aeneas is in the story, he is the son of Aphrodite. He is one of the heroes, kind of a peer of Hector. And during that time, he fights one-on-one with Achilles and avoids dying and things along those lines. So a great epic sort of story and hero. Later on, during the time of Augustus, Aeneas' story is fleshed out a little more, and you have the Aeneid, which is a epic poem that details his travels from the destruction of Troy, where he makes his way across the Mediterranean to get to Italy, which is Rome. So this is, again, the mythic founder, the one that the Romans trace themselves back to. There's a Renaissance painting of Aeneas leaving Troy with his wife and child and carrying his father out. Eventually, all his family members die. He ends up going to Rome, marrying what would be Rome, marrying the locals, intermingling with them, etc. So some of his descendants later on, Romulus and Remus, these are the two twins, right? So you may have heard of them before. They were allegedly fathered by Mars, which is the god of war, right? So you'll see a pattern here throughout all this time with, like a lot of ancient foundation myths, there's a lot of violence, a lot of assault, a lot of things, and these are important because they're in the psyche of the ancient peoples, right, and kind of justifying what they did, how they saw the world. You know, it's a violent, it's a dangerous place, and we have to be dominant and attack all these other people before they attack us. So Romulus and Remus, like I said, they were abandoned at birth. They were raised allegedly by a she-wolf, and then they were eventually grafted back into the aristocracy of the of Aeneas' descendants, right, the king that was ruling. And then they had a quarrel between themselves as to what to name this new city they were founding. So Remus wanted to name it something. Romulus obviously wanted to name it Rome. They have a quarrel. Romulus kills his brother, right, so he murders him. And then he founds a city on the seven hills of Rome, and obviously it's named after himself, which is where we get the name Rome from. Okay? Traditional founding date is April 21st, 753 BC. Obviously, there's an asterisk associated with that. To put that in perspective with biblical timelines, that's around the reign of Uzziah in Judah, right? So that's kind of where we are right now. So Israel's been established for a really long time. Rome is just getting started, right? So that's kind of where we are right there. Later on, Rome is basically founded. It attracts a lot of guys who we could call bandits, right? So it's a lot of male-heavy population. They don't have a lot of women. Then you have this infamous incident that's called the Rape of the Sabines, so the Sabine women. So what happens is the Romans are trying to intermarry with all the local cities, right? They can't get any wives or anything like that. So they decide to basically trick the locals. So they have a big festival and say, hey, come look at this great city we're making, right? This is the Will Hubbard version of the story. But basically, they say, come look at this great city that we're founding. Everybody comes over. They basically drive the men off, steal the women, and then that's how they get watched, right? So kind of a Benjamite situation you have going on there. Anyway, so a big war breaks out. The women end up intervening and saying, we're all related to each other now, so let's not have what's the equivalent of a civil war. And that's, again, how the Romans ended up getting wives, basically. You have seven kings of Rome from the time of Romulus. There's all their names. I'm not going to go through them, but they're all very famous, right? And then you get down here to this guy who's Tarquin the Proud, okay, is what he's called. So Tarquin is basically a bad king, for lack of a better term. During his time, he's kind of brutal and oppressive and all this sort of stuff. His son ends up insulting a leading nobleman's daughter, right? So basically, he assaults her, and then that outrage causes them to rebel, the Roman people to rebel against Tarquin and his family, drive them out of Rome, and then you have the foundation of what's called the Roman Republic. Okay? So this is the famous republic that we have. It's called the Senatus Populus Romanus, which means the Senate and the people of Rome. So that's SPQR when you see that abbreviation. So right there. So that's the, that's what that means. Okay? The, basically this is a really, like I said, we're moving pretty fast, but this is basically the organization of the Republic. You have the consuls, which are the two executives, right? They each hold equal power. So the Romans were always afraid that we don't want to have a king. We don't want to have somebody who has ultimate power. So let's just appoint two guys who are both equally in charge. It helps not having a king. It doesn't help getting a lot of things done because these two guys overrule each other all the time, right? And they're always squabbling. But that's kind of the idea. So you have the two consuls. The consuls are elected for a year-long term. They are elected by the people, okay? The Senate is the legislative body, is what we'll call it. They actually did a lot more than just legislature, but they were composed of the 300 patricians. So these are kind of the highest families in Rome. It was roughly 300. It was later expanded as time went on. But the Senate is basically, like I said, the ultimate governing body of the Roman people. And then you have the people themselves. This is a popular assembly, so this is like the electorate, for lack of a better term. And they actually elected the magistrates. They held some judicial functions, things along those lines. And then they also would judge a lot of cases of like bribery, malfeasance, that sort of thing. Okay, Rome didn't really have a actual judicial system like we have. That's a function of the government. It was a lot of private accusations that were then brought before the popular assembly and later in front of juries. Okay? So that's kind of the organization of the Senate, the Republic, kind of how that functioned, right? Okay. Whenever you're studying the history of Rome, it's a lot of wars, right? I have two full slides that just list all these people that the Romans conquered and attacked. It is not exhausted by any means. Okay? So basically, when, and I got this nice little GIF here, kind of plays a little slow, but it expands over time, that shows all the people the Romans fought against. So again, Rome is roughly right there. Starts here as one city-state in the middle of a ton of city-states, okay? And then it's fighting against all their neighbors. They fight against the Latins, against the Etruscans. Basically, then you have the infamous incident where the Gauls, Gaul is roughly modern France. It was actually, it's a people group. It's not a geographic location necessarily. But they covered a lot of area. But these migrating barbarians come down here. They sack Rome. That's the infamous incident where basically Rome is not necessarily destroyed, but depopulated and a lot of people killed and all that sort of stuff. It's a very foundational incident in their history. Another one of the reasons why they are one of these kind of uber aggressive people. Okay? So again, against the Gauls, against the Samnites. Samnites are kind of down here in this area. So they push down in here, start conquering the Italian peninsula, and then against Pyrrhus. Not to get on a sidetrack, Pyrrhus is one of my favorite generals of the Hellenistic world. So he was related to Alexander the Great, so he's a Greek guy. He's over here, right there, on the side of Greece. And so he basically comes over, tries to help fellow Greek cities in the toe of the Italian boot. Romans fight against him. Romans ends up winning, basically. Pyrrhus is where we get the term Pyrrhic victory, if anybody's ever heard that before, because after beating the Romans in one victory, he lost so many people that he said, one more victory is going to do me in, basically, at this point. So anyway, so that's one of those, and don't worry, we're not done. There are more wars associated with this. So those are all wars kind of in Italy. So Rome expands over a couple centuries from their foundation up until about, let's say, 200-300 BC, somewhere in that time. That's where it really kicks off, okay? So they do wars outside of Italy against the Carthaginians. If you don't want to know where Carthage is, it's right there, Okay, so it's in North Africa. They founded this big North African empire. They were from Tyre and Sidon. So if you see that in the Bible, that's where the Carthaginians came from. So they had a big empire right there. The Romans fought three big wars against them, ended up defeating them later on. If you want to learn more, I know a guy who's got a podcast, so he'll be able to go in more depth for you. Against the Macedonians. So again, Macedonia is over here. A lot of Paul's letters relating to Macedonia and Greece, etc. Macedon is where Alexander the Great is from. So the Romans fought against them. Iberia is the ancient name for Spain, right? So they fought a lot against Spain. The Diadochi, these are Alexander's heirs, the generals, right? So they're fighting all over here. And then it gets to Gaul, Germans, and Britons. Gaul is roughly there, Germany, obviously, and then Britain. So basically, the Romans fought against all these people for hundreds of years, and they ended up, as you can see from this little map, expanding all the way out, having an empire that basically covered the entire Mediterranean. The Romans even had a term for this where they said the Mediterranean is Mare Nostrum, means our sea, right? So it belonged to them, right, as opposed to all these other people. So that's kind of where we are with regards to Rome. Rome expands. Rome gets a lot of wealth. Rome is, you know, enjoying living the high life. And then all of a sudden, we start having civil wars, right? So the first century BC is infamous for all the civil wars that happened. This is the time from basically 100 years before the birth of Christ is where we are right now. Okay? So during this time, you have the social war. This is a civil war that's fought between the Romans and the local Italian allies that they have. Then you have the rise of these warlords, is what we'll call them, right? So these, you remember the consuls, you had these two guys that were the consuls all the time. Competition becomes so extreme for the consulship that the Romans end up basically, the guy who loses ends up fighting a civil war with the other guy, is basically what happens a lot of times. That's a gross oversimplification, but we'll kind of use it for today. You have Marius versus Sulla. Those are the first kind of two guys that fight. The only reason that's notable is Sulla is the guy that first marches on Rome. So you always have the famous Julius Caesar, you know, crossing the Rubicon, that sort of thing. Well, he's basically following in the footsteps of this guy named Sulla, who lost out and then ended up actually being the first that took legions into the Roman city, right? Because they weren't allowed to basically cross a certain river to go into Rome in arms, right? Because, you know, Romans are always afraid of kings and all that sort of stuff. So you have Marius versus Sulla. Marius's nephew is Julius Caesar. Okay? So that's kind of how Julius Caesar is related to the first civil war. So Caesar rises. He has a spectacular career. He ends up getting appointed kind of late in life. It was roughly in his late 40s, early 50s to be a general. And that's where he does all his campaigns against the Gauls. So here's that famous photo of a Gallic king surrendering to Julius Caesar. Right? And can you all see? Is this in the way? Okay. Very good. So, anyway, Julius Caesar fights all these campaigns. He's a great general and all this sort of stuff. He fights in Gaul, Germany, Britain for a little bit, and then goes east. That's where he meets Cleopatra, fathers a child, all that sort of stuff. And so then Caesar famously fights a civil war against a guy named Pompey. Pompey was the other great leader during the time. So they kind of duke it out for the benefit of, you know, Pompey claims he's trying to save the Republic. Caesar is basically becoming a dictator at this point. And then Pompey ends up losing. So, and Caesar wins. And that's where we get Julius Caesar being assassinated by a guy named Brutus, right? And then basically Caesar is dead at that point. Caesar's nephew is Octavian, who becomes Augustus. Okay? So Julius Caesar doesn't have any natural born children in wedlock, right? So he basically adopts his nephew, whose name is Octavian, to be his heir. And he basically adopts Octavian a couple months before he dies. And so it's kind of one of those odd little events of history where I know he wasn't expecting to die at that point. And then all of a sudden he picked kind of this random teenager, right? Octavian's only 18 when this civil war breaks out. So basically Octavian ends up fighting with a bunch of other people, but specifically Mark Antony and Cleopatra, okay? Cleopatra is the famous Egyptian queen, right, who's ruling Egypt during this time. Octavian fights with her and her lover, Mark Antony, who's Octavian's rival. Octavian ends up beating them at what's called the Battle of Actium, right? So basically he wins, he closes the door on all the civil wars, and then he becomes Augustus, okay? And there's the statue of Augustus. He becomes the princeps or princeps, okay? What that means is like first or chief or something along those lines. He never called himself an emperor, Okay, we call him an emperor because we recognize in hindsight that basically he's the ruler of the time. But they had a veiled monarchy because, you know, the Romans hated monarchy. That's allegedly why they killed Julius Caesar. So that's why we have this kind of, again, veiled monarchy that's called the Principate. Senate kind of becomes a vestigial organ at this point. Augustus goes over and says, hey, I want to do this thing. What do you think about it? Surprise, surprise, they all agree and think it's a great idea. So then you have the reorganization of the provinces. It basically becomes imperial provinces are provinces that Augustus rules directly. Senatorial is basically he lets the Senate do some things, right, just to kind of give them something to do. But basically all the important provinces become imperial provinces. Basically Augustus is ruling them directly, right? So the empire is shaken up, changed, all that sort of stuff. Augustus, due to his experience in the Civil War and looking back in the recent history with, you know, the past 100 years, creates what's known as the Praetorian Guard. This is basically his old soldiers, and he says, hey, I don't trust the army. I'm going to create a standing guard of people in Rome itself, and I'm going to banish all the legions from being in Italy. I'm going to be the only guy who has my, basically, you know, my personal bodyguard. So basically, I'm in control now of all this sort of stuff. Okay? Now, the Roman Empire makes us think that there's a Roman soldier every 5 feet, you know, and all this sort of stuff, and checkpoints and all that sort of stuff. That's not actually what happens. There's a lot of local autonomy and rulers that are allowed to remain in place. Specifically, one of the most famous ones is Herod the Great, which we're going to get to in a second. But basically, you know, you look at a map and it's all painted red and you think, well, Rome controls all this. And, you know, you have, like I said, checkpoints and bureaucracy and all that sort of stuff. It's not quite how it works. And I got a map that's going to show that in just a second. Before I do that, we're doing really good on time. Questions. I know that was really fast. Does anybody have any questions for me while we're sitting here? We're all up to date. Good. There'll be a test later. Okay. Great. All right. So here's the map. And like you can see, it's not just everything red, right? You have all these splotches all over the place. Now, some of these are conquests that are added later. But specifically, I want you to take note of the things in blue, right? These are local kingdoms that are basically allowed to continue in existence, right? Rome gets tribute and all this sort of stuff, but they don't really interfere in their affairs, right? One of the interesting things about Rome is Rome basically said a lot of times that we want you to handle your own affairs internally, right? Only bring, again, for lack of a better term, important stuff to our attention, okay? So, and again, this kind of plays a little bit into the crucifixion story and things along those lines, because that's why you have these dual jurisdictions going back and forth, right? That's why you have the Pharisees having this dialogue with Pilate, because the Jews were not allowed to execute a capital sentence. That's Rome's prerogative, right, on these sort of things. So that's why you have this kind of bouncing back and forth that happens associated with that. Okay? So anyway, that's what we have going on here with the patchwork Roman Empire. And basically, they expected the local peoples to continue existence, pay tribute, all that sort of stuff, police themselves, etc. Okay? Pause real quick. Note, I'm a military history buff, so I just want us all to understand what a legion looks like really quickly. So basically, the legions were originally levied as citizen soldiers, right? So this is like you have your farmers. They say, it's time to go to war. Everybody get your sword. Go out, and we're going to go fight. That sort of thing. Okay? And then when the war's over, we all go home to our farms. Well, as you can see, as Rome fought more and more wars, it takes more and more time, all that sort of stuff, you have this transition to professional soldiers under, traditionally it's credited to Marius, may or may not have happened before or after him, but basically it becomes professional soldiers at this point. By Augustus's time, the paper strength of the legion was roughly 5,500 infantry and 200 auxilia. Auxilia, the Roman legionary had to be a citizen, right, of Rome. He had to have Roman citizenship. Auxilia were like local peoples that are non-citizens that served as specialists that the Romans didn't want to do, like cavalry, archers, things along those lines. Fun fact, century, it's not actually 100 men, it's 80 men. So that's confusing to everybody. So, but that, even though it means 100 men, it's technically 80 men. Some people think it's like 80 fighting men and like 20 staff. We're not sure. But basically, when you see that, it's a guy in charge of 80 people led by a centurion. Obviously, centurions pop up a lot in the Bible. So that's where we have that. If anybody wants to look online, there's the actual organization of the legion. If you want to see like really detailed for all our bolt counters in here. And then that's kind of a fun little graphic of the evolution of the Roman armor. So basically, you kind of had, again, farmer sort of guys over here, and then it kind of moves, and you get more professionalized people there. And there's a picture of the modern reenactor as a centurion.
Is that you?
I wish it was me, but no, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. All right. So you remember Augustus wins. Augustus basically settles peace along the entire Roman Empire and says, you know, since he is basically in control now, nobody is strong enough to challenge him. You have this, what's called the Roman Golden Period. It's also known as the Pax Romana, Roman peace, right? There's a little jab here that a Roman writer called. He put it in the name of a guy who got conquered. And he basically says the Romans make a desert and call it peace. So anyway, it's kind of, again, a little jab associated with that. Obviously, conquest was brutal and all that sort of stuff. But there were some benefits to the Roman Pax Romana, to the Roman system of government. One of the big ones was security of travel and trade, right? So you go through this time, you know, you got the famous Roman roads. So since they have peace and for the government and the movement of legions, they build all these roads. I have a couple of quick facts about the roads for those of you who would be interested. Roman road network, they have 29 great military highways that came from the capital. So, you know, the statement, all roads lead to Rome. It's because of these roads, right? Because they was famous associated with that. Basically, you had 113 provinces interconnected by 372 great roads, right? So not a highway, but a road. And the whole comprised more than 250,000 miles of road, of which over 50,000 miles were stone paved. Right? So that's quite the achievement, especially without any modern tools or anything along those lines, right? So you basically have them building these massive road networks, a lot of which are still in use today, right? Again, aqueducts, the other famous kind of Roman engineering technique to bring fresh water from far outside to cities, things along those lines. So there is an improvement kind of generally in the quality of life for certain people, right? Important caveat. Greek is the lingua franca, so basically, Romans can't take credit for this necessarily, but because you have the entire empire, you need this language that everybody can communicate in. Culturally, the Romans are very related to the Greeks, right? So they really enjoyed a lot of Greek stuff, even though they tried to claim it as their own. So thus you have like Ares, the god of war. Mars is kind of the discount copy of that, right? Walmart brand god. And so, anyway, so that's basically what happens. But you have this common culture, right? This common language, the Romans foster this, all that sort of stuff. And then kind of dovetailed into that, legally you have Roman citizenship. So the Romans are very good about basically conquering people and then integrating them into their society. Okay? A lot of people were not that way in the ancient world, right? They were very, they didn't like to assimilate foreigners. They wanted to keep them separate and different from them, right? But this Roman citizenship basically allowed for people to be integrated. And curiously enough, a lot of the conquests, you don't see a lot of rebellions after the first or second generations of conquests, right? Because there are benefits to being a member of the Roman system. One important exception to that are the Jews, right? Which we're going to get to in a second. Okay? So, benefits, right? Obviously, a lot of drawbacks, right? So, biggest one, slavery, okay? This is a picture of the island of Delos, okay? And it's kind of in the Aegean Sea. Basically, it was a huge slave trading emporium, so it's estimated hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people came through this during the Roman Empire to be sold as slaves, okay? Slaves did not have really any rights, right? They were the property of the master. Master could basically do with them what they wanted to. They did have, for slaves that had specialized skill sets, right, they could be freed and things along those lines. Vast majority of slaves were never freed. Vast majority of slaves, especially in rural estates that were working like these giant farms and things like that, short life expectancy, bad life, right? You had oppression. So basically, Roman governors would take advantage of their power. So again, surprise, surprise. They would require a lot of things, a lot of payments, kind of protection money rackets, things along those lines from the people that they governed. And it's basically one of the guys when he went out to be a governor, he came back and the first thing his friend asked is, how much money did you make? Right? So kind of their view of what the government was for, right? It's to get yourself and your friends rich. The Romans also did not have kind of a centralized method of taxation, at least early on. Augustus changed that. So basically they would hire these locals who would be tax collectors, right, to gather money and things along those lines. And those guys had a huge incentive basically to inflate the taxes that were owed, give Rome its cut, and keep the other portion. So there's, you know, Zacchaeus, right? He's the example why he has to pay back all that sort of stuff. You have few rights for non-citizens. These were called the peregrini. That means foreigner, right? So basically, if you're a Roman citizen, you get all these extra legal protections, right? That's why one of the reasons Paul, right, was traditionally killed by sword as opposed to by being crucified. Also why he could appeal his case to Caesar as opposed to like Peter, who's not a Roman citizen, right? So especially against Roman citizens, the foreigners, the peregrini, did not, were at a severe disadvantage, okay? And then you have a lot of moral issues associated with that. Abortion, basically accepted, right? We don't have an issue with that, especially infanticide, which is exposure of the infant, right? So you would have an infant that's born, you would set them out and just let them die, right? Very common practice, one that the early Christians spoke against and also worked hard to remedy by going and getting the babies and things like that. Sexual promiscuity, basically the Romans didn't really have a huge issue with what we would term sexual sins. They were not quite as bad as the Greeks, but that is a compared to what, right? Relative comparison, because few people were as bad as the Greeks. Curious kind of side note on that, homosexuality was tolerated in the Roman Empire, but it was never approved of, right? So you see a lot of revisionist history of people going back and basically saying, like, certain emperors who are, like, flagrant about their behavior were, like, heroes and all that sort of stuff. That's not the case. They were actually kind of looked down on. It's basically, we're okay if you do this, but don't make a big deal about it publicly, all that sort of stuff, right? So kind of curious, interesting there. But again, not a good time if you were a child, a woman, or a slave, right, to be alive would be during the Roman Empire, generally speaking, okay? Okay, so that's kind of your broad overview. We're going to zoom in real fast in the next 15 minutes or so, and we're going to talk about Judea in the time of Christ, okay? So you remember in the, sorry, it says Easter, happy Easter, but it should be Easter. The Eastern Mediterranean autonomy. Basically, in the East, right, you had these very sophisticated developed city-states, right, these really large cities. So you would have, like, your Antioch, your Ephesuses, things along those lines, Alexandria, right? The Romans, like I said, kind of took over these places, and they were like, why mess with a good thing? They're running really well. If you pay us tribute and all this sort of stuff and, you know, raise these cases, any big cases that we need, we'd be okay with you continuing under your kings, ethnarchs, and then you have some governors that were appointed. An ethnarch is just kind of a ruler of a local ethnicity, right? So Herod would qualify as an ethnarch, right? So basically, you had all this patchwork system of how this was run. Okay, so one of the reasons Rome got involved is basically, I know Steve talked last week about the Maccabees, right? So you had all the Maccabee stuff, you had all the great Hellenistic empires, specifically the Seleucids and the Ptolemies that were fighting back and forth specifically over the Promised Land, right? Then they obtained independence over the Hasmonean dynasty. And then they have an internal civil war in Judea, and then they invite Pompey the Great. So you remember him. He was the guy who fought against Julius Caesar. They invite Pompey in to intervene. One side does. Pompey shows up, conquers Jerusalem. Basically, that's how they get involved in Judea at that time. And that's in 63 BC, traditionally dated. Okay? So during that time, Rome is basically involved. But again, Rome is like, continue to do your thing. We have our local guy that we put on the throne, pay us tribute, all that sort of stuff. So then you have all these internal politics, and basically then you have Herod the Great, who's appointed as client king by Rome, okay, in 40 BC. So Herod goes to Rome, Herod has to ask something, and then the Senate basically says, you can be king now. Again, gross oversimplification, but that's basically what happens. So that's how Herod ended up becoming a king backed by Rome at that point. Herod expands the Second Temple, so this is kind of digital recreation of what that may have looked like. So he does these really big building projects, and Herod the Great is the king during the Massacre of the Innocents, right, where he goes, that's the one that's sent into Bethlehem to, you know, with the wise men and kill all the babies and that sort of thing. This is a real tangential side note, but again, as a history buff guy, the Galatians, right, the people that God, that Paul wrote the, I guess God wrote the letter to.
Yeah.
But so anyway, the Galatians, they were originally Gauls, right, that migrated and settled in the middle of Asia Minor. And they served as mercenaries a lot of times for the local Hellenistic kings. So they, you know, the Hellenistic kings were, they wanted these big, tall, blonde guys, like, guarding them and all that sort of stuff. And anyway, so some people theorize that they are actually the ones that were Herod's soldiers that were involved in the massacre of the innocents. So very speculative, but kind of interesting. So a little side note there. All right. So then during the time, Herod basically rules Judea, right? And then you get what's known as the Herodian Tetrarchy. A tetrarchy is like a division, right? And then basically at Herod's death, which is approximately 4 BC, sometime around then, it's disputed. But basically his will stipulates that he wants his kingdom divided between his sister, who's Salome the First, which implies there's a second, and his sons Herod Archelaus, Herod Antipas, and Philip. Okay? So Herod's kingdom, one big thing, divided basically into four separate regions. We're going to look at a map in just a second. Herod Archelaus is traditionally viewed as the king that's ruling when Joseph is coming back from Egypt. And Joseph hears that Herod's son, Herod Archelaus, is ruling in Nazareth. Basically he's ruling the area. I think it's in Bethlehem or wherever he was at originally. Sorry, I'm blanking on that. But basically, Joseph hears about it, Matthew 2, he moves him to Nazareth, right? Herod Antipas basically rules like Jerusalem and areas like that. Then he is he's ruling like Nazareth and things along those lines. This is traditionally the Herod views with the death of John and the trial of Jesus, okay? Herod Antipas. The reason this is relevant is basically because these are kind of the divisions. So basically Archelaus has this pink stuff here, Antipas has the blue, right? Like I said, the reason this is relevant is because this is where you get the overlapping jurisdictions that happened during the crucifixion, okay? So basically, you kind of have this odd little interaction that if you didn't know about it, you think it would be like a conflict or something like that, because what happens is, I'll come back to this in just a second, Judea becomes a Roman province because Augustus removes Herod Archelaus, which is one of the sons, from being the king, right, due to incompetence, cruelty, things like that. And then Augustus basically makes this, a couple things, Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, which is kind of like where Edom used to be. They become an actual Roman province ruled by Rome, okay? The reason this is relevant is this is basically, with some extra stuff, what becomes ruled by Rome at that time, okay? But Herod Antipas is still up here, okay? Jesus is from Nazareth, right? So that's where you get Pilate has jurisdiction over Jerusalem, right, which is why they bring him to Pilate. Herod Antipas has jurisdiction over Nazareth, so when Pilate hears that Jesus is from Nazareth, he sends him over to Herod, right, because he's like, he's from your place, see what you want to do with him, right? So that's where you get that kind of going back and forth. So if you didn't know this, it'll be confusing because you'd be like, well, I thought Rome was ruling, where does all these people fit? That's how they all fit together. Okay? So, kind of just talked about this. Formally becomes a Roman province, so it actually has a Roman governor sent out there at that time. Pontius Pilate, it's thought to be the fifth Roman governor, okay? And then that's where we talked about the jurisdictional overlap during that time. So again, Rome ruling this directly, Pilate is the governor here. Technically, Pilate kind of is over these other guys, but they also have some local autonomy, and then that's where you get, again, overlapping jurisdiction. As an attorney, I think that's very interesting. Whether you do or not, you know, your mileage may vary. Okay. Fast forwarding a little bit, this is kind of getting to the end, right? Literally. Basically, you have the Great Jewish War, or the Jewish War is what it's called, or the Great Jewish Rebellion. This is the kind of infamous AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem, how this all builds out. You have what's called the Zealots. Josephus calls them the fourth sect of Judaism. The other three sects being the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, right? From like Dead Sea Scrolls. So the fourth sect of Judaism, they're close to the Pharisees in doctrine, but they basically have, they're a political movement. They have this radical insurgency against Roman hegemony. There's a quote from Josephus that it says, God is to be their only ruler and Lord. Basically, we don't have anybody above us, especially not these, you know, dirty Romans. Okay? They basically kind of are founded and are a low-level insurgency from about 6 AD. Depending on your point of view, the Romans would call them terrorists, the Jews would call them freedom fighters, so to put it in modern parlance, that's kind of what you're looking at. There's a rebellion in 66 BC due to religious tension, economic grievances, so basically people are being exploited. You have all these religious tensions going on, like the Roman governor said, demanded the money in the temple, right? Which obviously is a sacrilege to the Jews. So, but, and that's common for Roman governors to do, is basically, you have this pile of money here, I want it, right, give it to me. And so, anyway, there's a huge rebellion associated with that. All these zealots pour out and all the common people. They actually capture Jerusalem. The Roman governor flees. Herod Agrippa II, which is the current ruler, or one of them, basically, he also runs away. And then they defeat the 12th legion, Fulminata. And so the Romans had this annoying thing where they basically didn't chronologically named legions. So basically you would have multiple 12th legions running around, right? So that's why you had this little extra thing. So there's a little tidbit for you. But anyway, the Jews actually defeat a full legion, kill a bunch of people, so they create a big problem. Nero is the current emperor at the time. Okay.
Can you go back one?
Yeah.
Slide?
Sure.
So that occurred, what is the 66 BC? Is that?
Sorry, that's supposed to be AD. Okay. I apologize.
Okay.
AD there. I will get that fixed. Yes, 66 AD, during the time of Nero, is this huge Jewish revolt, right? So basically, they send out this guy named Vespasian, right, who's kind of this seasoned general at this point, with four legions. Remember our math with the paper strength of the legion, that's roughly 22,000 men, actual legionaries, plus the auxilia, which we have no idea how many people there are. Suffice to say, this is a huge army that shows up, right? They have these outer sieges, so if we look at a map, what they start doing is they start basically coming in at all sides, they take all these strongholds and start driving all the people into Jerusalem, okay, is basically what happens. So they drive, they close, like I said, I'd say it's closing the noose, but basically Vespasian has this idea that I'm not going to just go straight to Jerusalem because I don't want to leave all these insurgents around, basically tearing up my supply lines and stuff like that. I'm going to just go methodically, city by city, drive everybody into Jerusalem, okay? What happens in AD 69 is Nero is assassinated, and then there's this civil war that breaks out. It's called the Year of the Four Emperors, because four emperors ruled during one year. Vespasian is tapped to be one of the emperors by his supporters, so he leaves, right? He goes away. He puts his son Titus in charge, okay? So that's how Titus ends up being the actual Roman general on the scene during the Siege of Jerusalem. Siege of Jerusalem lasts a while. Basically, you have the zealot infighting, so the zealots are due to their kind of fractured nature. They fight with each other during the entire siege. The populace is kind of caught in between warring factions. So basically, like, one faction controls the temple, one faction controls the palace. They're street fighting and all this sort of stuff against themselves, plus the Romans. So it's really a bad time. One kind of infamous incident is one of the zealot factions, not quite sure which, basically set fire to all the food stores in Jerusalem to basically make the populace stay and fight, right? So they were basically like, there is no retreat, you will stay here and die with us kind of thing. So they burned all the food stores, so that's where you get a lot of suffering with people starving and things along those lines. During this entire time, Romans are trying to push into the city. You have the destruction of the temple. So Titus actually wanted to keep the temple from being destroyed, right? Not from any necessarily altruistic motive. He wanted to turn it into like a temple to Jupiter and all this sort of stuff. But again, God in his providence decided that the second temple would be destroyed. So that temple is burnt down, and that's where you get kind of the modern setup with the temple. So Rome has destroyed it. Never been rebuilt since then. You have the devastation of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is sacked and basically razed to the ground, right? The Romans just either kill or enslave everybody, kick them all out, and then Jerusalem is leveled. Eventually a Roman garrison is sent there to be at that place. Good, 4 minutes. So then you have the bark. So that's what happens. Now, there's not a vast depopulation of Judea itself during that time, right? So, you know, it is the end of the Jews basically as a political entity because you destroy the actual temple, right? Judaism has to go through all these kind of revolutions to try to deal with that fact because you can't do the sacrifices anymore and all that sort of stuff. That's where you get modern Judaism basically adopts the Pharisaical traditions at that point, right? Sadducees are really based around the temple. Once that's gone, they decline in power. Pharisaical doctrine is basically adopted. And then that's kind of where you get modern Judaism stemming from that. Okay? Anyway, fast forward about 60, 70 years. There's actually another revolt in between this. There's three great Jewish revolts. But there's the third and final Jewish revolt. It is called the Bar Kokhba revolt. Bar Kokhba is one of the guys that led it. He first was called the Son of Promise. And then after he lost, he's called the Son of Deceit. So that kind of shows where everything goes. basically during the Bar Kokhba revolt, this is during the time of Trajan and Hadrian, for you Romophiles out there. But basically, the revolt is put down, right? Judea is depopulated, they drive everybody out, and there's a mass enslavement, and then mass relocation of Jewish people at that time. I had some notes. So Cassius Dio basically says roughly 580,000 men were killed, sold into slavery, or exiled at that point. That's just men, right? Doesn't include women and children necessarily. Modern scholars go back and forth about it, but suffice to say, basically, that's where you get a massive Jewish diaspora at that time. Okay? And to add insult to injury, Judea is renamed Syria Palestina, which is where you get the name Palestine, right? So basically, the Romans, it's disputed whether this is directly related to the Bar Kokhba revolt, but you could see them basically saying, you've revolted three times, we're really tired of dealing with this, so we're going to level you as a political entity, and then we're going to rename it Palestine, which some people think is a callback to the Philistines, right? So maybe, maybe not. But that's what basically where that all comes from. Okay? All right. So there you go. We did it. History of Rome in 45 minutes, and we have time for questions.
Why was Paul one and Peter wasn't?
Right, great question. So normally the qualifications for Roman citizenship, it is a thing that is awarded, right? It is not necessarily a thing that is granted automatically unless you were born into it, right? A lot of people theorize, and you know, maybe Steve can jump in on this, but a lot of people theorize that the Jews were big supporters of Julius Caesar, right? There was a lot of Jewish soldiers that served in Caesar's army. It's a possibility that and Julius Caesar was out in the east for a long time. There's some speculation that basically, because Paul was born into a citizenship, right? That means his father had to acquire citizenship. He may have served in the army, or he may have, his father may have served in the army, or he may have done a favor for Caesar or one of the other generals or governors, right? And then they awarded him Roman citizenship. A lot of people that submitted to Rome and started cooperating with them, one of the rewards they got was Roman citizenship, right? Integration in the Roman society. So, couple speculations there, but yeah, that's typically what it was. It's either awarded typically for military service or some other service for the state. Other questions?
Masada.
Masada is roughly 72 AD. So the temple is destroyed at 70, and then they let Romans mop up the remaining Jewish resistance at that time. So usually that ticks on for about two more years. So somewhere between 70 and 72 AD is where Masada is destroyed.
So that's where, how's that they were clustered up, they went up there for,
they wanted to,
was that the last remnant?
Yes.
So after the siege or whatever? Or,
mm-hmm. So any survivors and, you know, some other remnants go over to Masada. It's kind of this wilderness hilltop fort thing. And they all sit up there and then they just wait for the Romans to show up and kill them all. And then they committed mass suicide before the Romans breached or attacked them, like went through the walls and sacked it.
They built a huge ramp.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans built a huge ramp to get up to Masada.
Mm-hmm.
It would have taken at least months for them to build this ramp.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the people up in Masada just kept watching the Romans get closer and closer and closer to them.
Yes, sir. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And you can still see the siege ramp today. So it's an impressive feat of engineering. So yeah, and a lot of, I listen to the Ancient Warfare History podcast, like I know you all do as well. And basically, but one of their points is, you know, with the Romans is, you're going to revolt all you want, but you will not get away with it, right? Like, we will sit here till the end and punish you for it. And Masada is a good example of that, right, where it's a bunch of kind of rebels up in this fort, and then they send a legion over there to basically build this giant ramp and destroy the last remnants of the rebellion. Other questions?
Is it thought that Barabbas was a zealot?
Potentially, yeah. So, but we're not certain. Interestingly, though, one of Jesus' disciples is Simon the Zealot, right? That's his name. So potentially he was a part of the movement. I mean, that would make sense.
Right. But, was Cicero a good guy?
I mean, it depends on your point of view. An attorney answer.
Both fathers loved him, right? John Adams.
Yeah, they thought he was great. He thought he was stuff.
Why do they like him so much?
Okay, so compared to Romans, the average Roman, then Cicero is a great guy. Compared to Jesus, right? Then maybe not so much. So, but yeah, I mean, he said and did a lot of good things, like a good pagan, right? And like again, according to Roman standards, he was a really just, upstanding sort of fellow. Other questions? Okay, good. I really appreciate you all listening. Let me talk today. Enjoyed it. I'm up here if you have any questions or anything like that, or if you want further reading, which I know you all do. Y'all have a happy Easter.